Now, I'll deviate a little bit, talking about the Templars. Because they had to live a very secret life with their rituals, to keep it away from the main church, they had to adopt techniques that allowed them to teach each other, because they were mainly illiterate. The knights were almost all illiterate. They had scribes who were not, of course. But they had to have the ability to teach people, and yet they hadn't to commit anything in writing that could be used as evidence against them. So they adopted a technique which was reasonably well known in the Middle East, and that was to have a series of cards that contained prescribed illustrations that they could show and tell a story to an educated person. But they could tell the story two ways: a harmless way that would mean nothing to anybody, and the way for they could explain to initiates. Now, these cards are still in existence. We call them tarot cards. They are very clearly Templar. People have some people have been noting this for a few years, but there is clear connection with the imagery and Freemasonry and with the Jerusalem Church. There was the Minor Arcana and Major Arcana. The Minor Arcana was 56 cards. It lost four of them after the demise of the Templars because the church tried to destroy the whole pack. But they succeeded in getting the four knights out because there was a king, queen, knight and jack. The knights represented the Templars. They were removed, so there's a king, queen and jack. So it's now reduced to 52 cards. The Major Arcana was far more important. The cards that were had things like the Hierophant, the Papess, the Fool. The Fool was the initiate, the person at the beginning of their journey who would end up being the wise person. Hopefully. The Hierophant card has often been associated with the Pope, but it's not the Pope, or at least it's not the Pope in Rome. It shows two pillars, freestanding pillars, and in between somebody sitting on a throne, usually with a collar, with a mitre. The Bishop of Jerusalem wore a mitre between two pillars, exactly how the Grand Master of Freemasonry now looks. I was recently in the Grand Lodge building in Philadelphia. They've got photographs from the last century of people sitting in their Masonic regalia, complete with mitre between the two pillars, identical to this card, identical to the way James the Just would have looked as he sat there in Jerusalem. So this card represented the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, because we believe that the Knights Templar returned to Jerusalem, found the documentation they were looking for, then re-established the Jerusalem Church. And the new Messiah, if you like, was the same role as Jesus and James had held. Their high priest took to wearing the mitre. So they gave allegiance to Rome only in name. I think they held the church with some respect, but they considered themselves to be super Christians, if you like, Jewish Christians. And therefore, that card represented their authority and power as the rulers of Jerusalem. The Papess card is interesting, really interesting. That's a female pope, or it looks like a female pope, because the first pope was a female. And there have been two female popes, in fact. The first pope was Mary Magdalene. That's what the Templars believed. She was black and she was comely, and her relationship with Jesus has often been spoken about, but it's very clear from many Gospels, so-called Gnostic Gospels, that there was quite a dynamic between Jesus and Mary and Peter, who quite clearly despised her, and she was frightened of him. But she was the first pope. We can be pretty sure of that. Jesus held her in very high esteem, and that the Templars knew. And they honoured that by having this card that showed it. Just as a matter of interest, in Siena Cathedral there is a bust of Pope John VIII. Underneath, there's a whole line of popes, and there's Pope John the Eighth. Underneath is a little plaque that says, Pope John the Eighth, an English woman. And so she was, because she fell in love with a monk who eventually died, and she entered the monastery, and she was pretty damn good and successful, and she ended up becoming a cardinal, and she ended up, no doubt much to her surprise, at some very young age, being made pope. Very inconveniently for all concerned, she died in childbirth in a papal procession. It is recorded by the Catholic Church, but they weren't too pleased, as you can imagine. And they took steps for it, that it should never happen again. And when a cardinal is named as the new pope, he has to remove his lower garments and sit on a little throne which has no bottom in it. And two people have to go below and inspect. And they have to say in Latin, he has testicles and they hang well. It's a fairly fail-safe technique, I think. We next turned our attention, because other people had made connections between the Templars and the legends of King Arthur. Now, can everything be connected to the Knights Templar? It sounds a bit incredible, but yes, it can, the more we looked. Because Arthur is supposedly an ancient British warrior, Welsh warrior king. But there was someone called Arthur, but that's it. Somebody called Arthur who was a warrior king. That's the whole story. That's all that's known. The first time it was written down, anything was written down, was from the pen of Geoffrey of Monmouth in 1136, the year that Hugh de Pern, the founder of the Templars, died. And the story that he wrote down is very much the story of the Rex Dias families, of their desolation, of their return. And the year later, that was added to by William of Malmesbury, who then introduced other elements of the story, and then other writers. And there was a great fighting as to who'd got the original story right. Now, there was no original story, other than Geoffrey of Monmouth was in connection in Oxford, in the city of Oxford in England, with a guy called Péan Montdidier, who was a Templar, who had been involved with the original Templars. And he was sent to England to become the senior Templar in England. And he must have been quite a blabber, because Geoffrey of Monmouth appears to have got the story from him, and he turned it into this story of King Arthur, which he said he got from ancient documents. When asked to provide them, he couldn't. So there was a great battle then ensued to try and suffocate the story from Rex Dias families and to rewrite it. And the battle continued for some time. A long time later, Christian de Troyes and Wolfram and people started embellishing the story. But it was a long time before it became the Christian story that we'd recognize today. The story of King Arthur was very different and very non-Christian originally. So an awful lot came out from these Knights Templar people. All of the major cathedrals of Europe, this great building program, Tarot cards, King Arthur, they were incredibly important. And yet they're regarded in history as a bit of a joke, a bit of an oddity. Now, the church has got ways of dealing with people that cause it a problem, that have what they call heretical beliefs or whatever. First of all, they start off with ridicule, and if that doesn't work, they move along to absorption. They just bring it in, and if that doesn't work, destruction, annihilation. The Cathars knew about the destruction with the Crusades that slaughtered tens and tens of thousands of people for their beliefs which deviated from the official line. Ridicule, they use all the time. Absorption is an interesting one because in Africa there are bishops who have got many wives because that is the tribal norm, so they allow that to happen. So they absorb all sorts of things in. They adapt themselves to handle these occasions. Now, we believe they had a particularly difficult time after the destruction of the Knights Templar. And I'm going to tell you a little bit now about the Shroud of Turin, which strangely also comes into our story very forcibly. You'll recall this is a piece of linen, some 14 feet long, which records the image of what appears to be a crucified man, front and back, one above the other. And since it was first put on display in 1357 in the town of Lery in France, there's been two schools of thought about it. One group say it's a forgery, and the others say, no, it's genuine. It's the image of Jesus Christ. Well, they're both wrong. It's not a forgery, but it's not the image of Jesus Christ. It actually is the image of Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar. The man that held the same position, the same job, if you like, the High Priest of Jerusalem, the last one to hold that position officially. Because on that day, in 1307, Friday the 13th of October, when Jacques de Molay was arrested in the Paris Temple, the Paris Inquisition were told to extract a confession from him to his guilt as a heretic. They took the Paris Temple, that's what they called the Templar building, more or less at dawn, watched by the king, and they had no means of torture with them. They didn't have a torture chamber there. They had to quickly extract a confession from this leader of the Templars. But the Paris Inquisition were well known, or the Inquisition generally were well known for their liking for nailing people to objects. So we believe that they were completely incensed when they were told that the Templars had been conducting a resurrection ritual and that they had denied the divinity of Jesus and the power of the cross, which indeed they did. And so they decided a very fitting way of torturing him would be to crucify him, because crucifixion had always been a form of torture rather than execution, because it takes days and days to die on a cross. You have to break your legs normally so that you suffocate as you're thrusted forward and you can't inhale. But they hadn't got to kill Jacques de Molay because he had to stand trial. He had to make a public confession, so they had to torture him but not kill him. And so they flogged him, they beat him, they thrust a crown of thorns on his head, and then they nailed him to a door. We believe it's a door because when you studied the blood flows, very clearly the right arm was vertically above and the left arm outsidewards, not in the conventional way at all. And a door would probably be the only large wooden object within that stone building. There are drawings still in existence of that building with very thick walls, and the inner temple, which is like a Masonic temple, had to have no windows, but it would have had at least one door. So they nailed him up and they charged him. They asked him to confess to two charges. One, that he denied the divinity of Christ and the power of the cross. And the other, that he had sanctioned and conducted homosexual acts in the rituals that they'd conducted as Templars. Now, this man is, a priest of the church as well as a warrior leader. And he confessed to one of those two, but steadfastly refused to confess to the other. He confessed pretty quickly that he denied the divinity of Christ and power of the cross, but absolutely refused to acknowledge that there'd been any homosexual acts conducted amongst the Templars. Now, you'd imagine it would be the other way around, because the Pope at the time was a well-known homosexual. There should have been no problem with that, but there's a big problem. He was going to get burnt at the stake for confessing, denying Christ. So we can only deduce that he was telling the truth. So he was taken down in a comatose state, probably pretty close to death. Not a happy man anyway. And he was placed in a soft bed, probably his own bed, and for the final irony, wrapped in his own shroud, the shroud that's still used in Masonic rituals, the shroud that was used originally, we believe, by the Jerusalem church and that were used by the Templars for this degree of figurative resurrection. And the image transferred from his body onto that cloth, which is a good theory, but how did it do it?